CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Good morning and welcome to City Talk's Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club Downtown Liverpool in Business. And every Sunday I'll be taking a look at some of the week's big business stories and talking to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider northwest region. This week, plans to boost the tourism industry in Merseyside to the tune of £100 million were unveiled in a three-year action plan by the Mersey Partnership. Can the Liverpool City region continue to develop its visitor and tourism economy? Following the withdrawal of funding from the North West Development Agency, the chief executive of business organisation Professional Liverpool has been made redundant. Has our city got an active enough professional services sector to support such a group independently? Plans to build a giant container ship terminal in Liverpool may be under threat because of new environmental guidelines designed to protect Merseyside's coastline. Liverpool Bay was made into the marine equivalent of a national park by the government last month, and it means permission to build the terminal, which would see a surge in the number and size of vessels coming into Liverpool, may be refused. Is the green agenda getting in the way of economic progress unnecessarily? Debates and discussions about the new local economic partnerships continue, and in the world of politics, or is it showbiz, former Prime Minister Tony Blair has released his autobiography and produced a book that, by all accounts, is well worth a read. To discuss all this and maybe more besides, I'm joined by three of my show's regular guests, Cushion King, local entrepreneur and chairman of the Liverpool Conservative Association, Tony Caldera, PR guru and the head honcho of Aurora Media, John Egan, and king of the fairies and downtown events manager, Roger Jonas. Good morning, chaps.
Good morning, Frank.
Let's start with the thing that people have been talking about relentlessly since Tuesday, Wednesday of this week, which is the Blair book. I know that, all three of you have been out of the country, actually, for some considerable time, such as the amount of cash that you've all earned. But nonetheless, you couldn't have missed the mass media coverage of Blair's book. It has been, I think, surprisingly frank in terms of some of the comments and revelations that have been made. I don't think any of us would be surprised to learn that he and Gordon Brown didn't get on particularly well. And one or two other things, though, in there that I think have stood out as being significant. John Egan, if I may come to you first, because obviously you were part of that whole New Labour project.
I knew nothing about it, Frank. I was completely innocent. It's a wicked rumour.
Paid official of the Labour Party during that time. And, you know, if we reflect back to that period, 94 to 97, it was a very exciting time within Labour politics, wasn't it? Because Blair burst onto the scene and was very much seen as the messiah, really, for the progressive movement in this country.
Yeah, and I think looking back on it, maybe that was the point at which we should have pinched ourselves and thought about what was happening, because it was, as you say, pretty messianic. It was more like a religious revival than politics that we'd previously known or experienced. And I think that kind of it's played itself out to its inevitable endpoint, which is somewhat tragic and bizarre in the way that his autobiography has been published and everything that's gone with it. But yeah, it was an incredibly exciting. Everybody was caught up in the febrile atmosphere of expectation, undoubtedly there was a need at that stage for Labour to be radical and to embrace the gospel of modernisation.
Mm. And it was 18 years of opposition, of course, to the Labour Party. And not only him, but people like Gordon Brown and Peter Mandelson and Alistair Campbell, who were all bringing books out, or brought books out, they were all part and parcel of this project, weren't they? It wasn't simply a one-man mission. And, you know, in the party at the time, there was a huge majority that signed up to that project?
I think signed up is the right word. I think it was actually a comparatively small number of people who hatched the project, who fully understood where it was going, who knew what the end point of it was. And I think everybody else was sort of caught up in it, and the idea that this was somehow going to catapult Labour into victory, which was, you know, something which was hugely appealing after 18 years in the political wilderness. But it was only like a little bit by bit that I think that the foot soldiers and even the apparatchiks, even people who were working for the party, were generally seduced into thinking that, you know, this was it. Oh, no, there's a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And you never really got the impression that the entire picture was being presented. And maybe they didn't quite know where they were going. I mean, that's the other aspect to this, that, you know, Blair was caught up with this notion of just this almost messianic mission, this idea that he was doing something to save the party, save the country and save the world ultimately. But whether in fact it had any ideological or intellectual core to it, it's become increasingly questionable. And the fact that now his memoirs are, you know, almost devoid of politics, it is entirely about his relations with his next door neighbour and his relationships with the key personalities. And it is almost imploded into effectively a story about him. And he was New Labour, in the same way that, you know, Peter Mandelson is also claiming to be New Labour, and, you know, the Three Musketeers and all the rest of it, that they became the kind of physical incarnation, the embodiment of this project. It was coterminous with them. Whatever they said, whatever they think, almost defines what New Labour is. And, you know, the utterances now about where we should be going, how we should be dealing with the deficit, and his rather unhelpful suggestions that maybe the coalition has got it right and the Labour Party has got it wrong.
Heaven forbid.
And if only he'd still been leader, Labour would have won the election. If he honestly believes that, the man is so deluded, he shouldn't be let anywhere near a major international peace negotiation. You know, he's on a different planet.
Well, you say that, John, but I picked up the point he was making last night, actually, in terms of the polls when he left office. Labour and Conservatives were neck and neck. I actually think that Labour got away with a much better election result than they anticipated. And I think that was partly to do with the fact that the Conservatives ran a very poor campaign, and then we had the television debates, which nobody has really factored in. I'm not so sure, you see, that this idea that Tony Blair is loathed by the vast majority of people in this country is actually true. I think there are a vocal minority who will come onto radio stations and write blogs and vent their anger at Blair, most particularly over the Iraq war. And I've some sympathy with that view because I was against the war at the time. But ultimately, again, as he's pointed out, he won three elections. Certainly one of which, if not two, were after he'd taken us into war with Iraq. And he was seen as somebody that had that, whatever you may call it, instinct, that ability to be able to speak to people in a way that made them feel as though he understood them. Now, whether that was a fantastic act, whether it was simply good politics, is open to question and arguable. But the fact of the matter is, John, Gordon Brown never, ever, ever made that connection, not whilst he was Chancellor and certainly not whilst he was Prime Minister.
No, I think you've been reading the book, Frank.
I've not read the book.
Buying the spin. But, Tony Blair won the election in 2005 and in exactly the same way that John Major won an election in 1992. He won it simply because the opposition was you know, unelectable. Michael Howard was an unsaleable proposition to the British electorate, you know, something of the night. I mean, even his own party genuinely didn't see him as being somebody who could be elected as Prime Minister. I think that the fundamental issue of trust, whether, you know, it's not necessarily about anti-war sentiment, it's not about sort of disillusionment with the ideology of New Labour, but there was a fundamental erosion of trust. The brand had become tarnished. Blair's own stock had diminished to the point where I don't think he was electable. In fact, when Brown was elected as leader of the Labour Party, there was a bounce, there was a boost. Labour was ahead in the polls and remained ahead in the polls, you know, for quite some period of time until the economy began to turn in the wrong direction. I think Labour's result was better than expected because Brown, despite his inability to connect with ordinary voters, quotes, or his ability to sell himself to Middle England, what he was able to do at the 11th hour was bolster support amongst Labour heartlands and get a much higher turnout than conceivably had been expected from Labour's core vote. I don't think Blair would have been able to do that. I don't think Blair would have been able to enthuse or inspire any Labour voters from that particular part of the New Labour coalition to go out and vote for him again. Mm. I think it was the fear of a Tory government as well, which probably helped Labour to salvage a slightly better result than they'd expected.
Mm. Mr Caldera, welcome, sir. Just
good
back
morning.
From China.
Indeed.
Who would you rather have fought at the last election, Gordon Brown or Tony Blair?
No contest. I'd have rather fought Gordon Brown any day of the week. Tony Blair was quite possibly the outstanding politician of his generation. And I say that as a Conservative.
Well, exactly.
As a Conservative.
Exactly.
You know,
as one of your own.
But I tell you what, I wish that Tony Blair had been a Conservative. I mean, forget the policies and the politics, the actual charisma of the man. Frank was looking for the word, but it's very easy. He had the X factor. And I say X factor as in X marks the spot on the ballot paper. Gordon Brown never had that. Gordon Brown can't even dream of having that personal touch and the charisma that Tony Blair had. And the people saw that. He was wooden. He plays too much emphasis on his economic abilities, which in the end deserted him when the economy went south. So he had very little to actually offer. I think the Labour Party in this part of the world, you know, performed a little better than most people had expected, frankly, because they mobilised the core vote very well. I think had it not been for that and it had just been the south of England, then the Labour Party would have been completely annihilated. I think you're not giving Tony Blair enough credit. I think for a man to take a party that was in the doldrums, going nowhere, to then make it not only electable, but to actually be the first Labour Prime Minister to get three terms in office, that's a very, very serious achievement, you know, and I say that as an opposition political activist. Respect to Blair, I think, as far as I'm concerned. The problem is now is, of course, you're now seeing what really went on. You're now seeing how divided the Labour Party was and still is. Of course, all political parties are a broad church. The Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats are exactly the same. But ultimately, it shows the book, you know, it's political dynamite, and I'm sure that the Sunday morning papers and the Sunday morning shows will have plenty on it this morning. But ultimately, we've got to remember that Tony Blair made the Labour Party electable, and since his departure, they haven't won any elections, and the electoral performance in local elections, in European elections, in general elections has gone down. Maybe that's part of the issue that they had with incumbency, but maybe it's because that Gordon Brown and the current crop of the leadership of the Labour Party didn't enthuse the public enough. They were fed up of the spending, they were fed up of the misguided economic policies, they were fed up of a lot of different things, and they wanted a change, the same as they wanted a change in 1997. They'd got fed up of New Labour and the fact that they'd nearly bankrupted the country, and they thought that we need to sort this deficit out, we need a fresh face, and they looked at David Cameron on election day in May and thought, actually, you know, let's give this guy a chance. He's making the right noises, he's doing what needs to be done, and he's got a plan. He's actually got a plan. All the Labour Party offered in the 2010 election were more of the same and no realistic plan to get rid of the deficit. But ultimately, the electors thought, especially in the south of England, that let's actually look at the Conservative Party. David Cameron changed the Conservative Party significantly in not too dissimilar way as the fact that in the way that Tony Blair changed the Labour Party. He moved the party towards the centre ground. He got rid of the nasty Tory image. And to be fair to him, he's a genuine, genuine guy who actually wants to help the country do better things. So as a result of all those things, I think you're harsh on Tony Blair. I think he's a much better politician than you're giving him credit for. And I think it's not just a question of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and the Labour Party navel-gazing. The fact of the matter is when it came to the 2010 election, the Conservative Party had a better proposition, won more votes and won more seats. It's as simple as that.
I think you see one of Blair's more positive legacies is the fact that he's managed to transform the way in which people view politics in this country. I mean, we did have a Conservative government that were going further and further to the right in the absence of a real opposition, because the Labour Party had shifted so far to the left that it wasn't seen as a serious proposition among most people. I think personality politics matter these days, whether we like it or not, and therefore Gordon Brown was always going to struggle in the top job of Prime Minister, in a similar way to Kinnock. You know, he's not on his own, Gordon Brown, in this regard. William Hague, when he was leader of the Conservative Party, really struggled in that top job. And I just think that, as I say, one of Blair's greatest legacies is the fact that the Conservative Party now have moved to the centre ground. Ironically, the Labour Party may be about to shift leftwards again, but we'll wait and see on that. But Roger, from a sort of outsider's perspective, what was your view of Blair's time in office, and what do you think of his revelations within the book?
I've just returned from holiday in Holland, and I tried to keep up as much as I could with the BBC News, which you can get over there. And there was a political correspondent from Bloomberg, I can't remember his name. He said, as you read the book, you can't help but quite like Tony Blair. And it made me laugh because, I go with what you say. I think Tony Blair played a massive part in making politics more accessible for Joe Public. I think then what happened to Gordon Brown came along and played his part in ruining that. I think the media didn't help, especially the debates. I wonder if the public voted for Cameron because Brown wasn't an option. That's my thought on it. He had no personality, and I think he set the country aside. I've never disliked Tony Blair, so the Bloomberg correspondent statement made me laugh a little bit. If I was asked who was my favourite Prime Minister in my life, it'd be a toss between Harold Wilson and Tony Blair. I kind of compare the two because I remember Wilson as a young lad growing up. And
you must be very old, Roger. You remember Wilson as a young lad. Oh, you were the young lad, sorry.
Oh, John.
See what happens when you're king of the fairies.
Yeah, watch yourself, John.
Yeah, you be careful.
You're under the spell.
I'll see you later as well, Caldera. I've always rated Tony Blair. I don't think the book has done him any harm. I think you're right. It does become more about him and his relationships, from what I understand. I haven't read it yet. I'm going to wait until for me it's like the political trilogy with Campbell, Mandelson and Blair, you know, coming out. It's a bit like Harry Potter, isn't it? There's always a trilogy.
Or Yoda and Obi-Wan Kenobi.
I was thinking
maybe the Three Stooges rather than the
I was thinking more Philip Pullman and his Dark Materials. It'll be a great trilogy to read. And I'm actually going to wait until I've got all three. Well, I'm going to wait until you've finished your copies. I'll borrow yours, Frank. I think there's, you know, politically there's an exciting bookshelf on the go at the moment. And as I say, I'm intrigued to read.
And again, do you know the other thing that struck me on Wednesday or Thursday, I think it was, Walter Stones came out and said it's the fastest ever political autobiography in terms of sales.
Yeah.
So we all hate this guy.
Oh, yeah, Frank, but listen, what you're basically saying is Tony Blair, what a great guy. He created this kind of...
No, what I'm saying, John,
this kind of soap opera politics.
I don't think there's, I don't think there's a balance in the debate, John.
It was
I
a compelling...
Yeah, we all hate him.
Order.
It was a compelling media spectacle. It was gossip, it was intrigue, it was drama, it was, you know, personal...
So was the introduction of the minimum wage not positive?
Three inconvenient facts to the...
Civic relationships.
Three inconvenient... convenient facts to the sort of mythology that's been spouted around the table for the last 10 minutes. One, the Labour Party was electable when Tony Blair took over. It was mild-head in the opinion polls. It was led by John Smith. Tony Blair did not carry out some extraordinary, miraculous, supernatural act of salvation for the Labour Party. He was the leader. What came after the bloke? What had already done that?
But that sells the books, though, John, doesn't
it? Yeah. Well, you know, let's not all consume the hype as if it's somehow established his political fact. Second point is, we talk about him winning the election in 2005. Labour got fewer votes in 2005 than it got in 2010 because the turnout was ridiculous. People may have found the whole Blair, Brown, Mandelson, New Labour sort of dynasty thing a compelling spectacle. But when it came to actually enthusing people about politics, people are basically turned off. Yeah. More people were actually turned on by Gordon Brown, David Cameron. And finally, Tony, I love what you said about David Cameron. People went out and voted. You know what? You didn't win.
But hang on a minute. Who is actually sitting? Is Gordon Brown in number 10 Downing Street?
Well, let's just get on to this.
So that, who is the Prime Minister? I'm sorry, John. You're not getting away with that.
You're being supported by Liberal Democrats. Even John Major managed to sort of, you know, contrive some sort of arithmetical majority under his own
state. He's still got a lot more votes and a lot more seats than your mates in the Labour Party.
There's more party division now, isn't there?
Can I just ask then, as we come to the close of the first part of the programme, and we will be talking about business after the break, listeners, do you think that one of the things that's demonstrated within the book, whether you love or loathe Mr. Blair, and there's clearly a split vote in here, coalition politics has actually been at work for 13 years prior to what we've got now, because there was so clearly a deal done between Gordon Brown and what his particular agenda was and the Prime Minister, Tony Blair. So are we actually seeing a continuation of compromise politics? And is that, again, not part and parcel of what Tony Blair, whether we love him or loathe him, I'll say it again, has delivered?
I think you'll find, Frank, that coalition politics has been going on for thousands of years, ultimately, because all three major parties, the Liberal Democrats have Liberals and Democrats. The Tories have wets and dry Tories. They have left-wingers and right-wingers. The same as there are socialists and there are new Labour's activists in the Labour Party. I think the most important thing here is actually to look a little bit further forward. You know, if Tony Blair was the Messiah and it was all about Tony Blair, then is the Labour Party now unelectable? And who is actually going to take this mantle forward? Will it be David Miliband? Will it be Ed Miliband? Will it be Andy Burnham? Will it be one of the other Ed Balls? Will it be Diane Abbott? Who's it going to be that's going to take that forward? And what are the implications of that for the Labour Party? Because with the exception of David Miliband, the rest of the candidates from the few snippets that I've managed to pick up while I've been away are all looking to take the Labour Party further to the left. And are they actually going away? Are they saying actually they are rejecting what Blair did and they think that actually Blair went too far?
John, coalition politics, nothing new really.
No, and I think, you know, one point where I will commend Tony and the Conservatives, I think the transparency of this current coalition is preferable, I think, to the sort of, you know, the dishonesty that clearly was at the core of New Labour. And the fact that they had this pretense of unity when actually they were, you know, throwing cups at each other across Downing Street. It's just, you know,
everyone knows Vince Cable hates everything that's going on anyway. Well,
his body language kind of gives it away a wee bit, doesn't it?
I just love the way Tony says, you know, in the Tory party there's wet and dry. Well, in my book, wet and dry is sandpaper, and that's always going to rub you up the wrong way.
Easy, tiger.
Right, well, on that note, we're just coming to the end of the first part of the programme. After the break, professional Liverpool, tourism, the green agenda and local economic partnerships. Stay with us. We'll be back in a mo.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined in the studio this week by Roger Jonas, Tony Caldera and John Egan. This week, plans to boost the tourism industry in Merseyside to the tune of £100 million were unveiled in a three-year action plan by the Mersey Partnership. Among the proposals, 10 new hotels across Liverpool and its city region, the creation of over 1,000 jobs and an economy, we're told, that already brings in over £1 billion. So can Liverpool continue to thrive as a tourist destination, or have we hit its peak? Tony, again, come to you, if I may. You've, as I said earlier, just returned from China. Shanghai Expo, obviously, is... It has exercised our minds for some time now, as Liverpool have got a huge jamboree over there, I'm told. It's going really well. Does China see Liverpool as a tourist destination, or does it see Liverpool as a place that they may be able to get involved with across other industry sectors?
Well, hopefully, Frank, the answer to that will be both. I think we discussed on the programme a few months ago that a lot of people visiting the expo would actually see Liverpool showcase for the very first time. And as a result of that, we would hopefully receive more visitors, we would hopefully receive more students, receive more inward investment, and with a little bit of luck, that will work quite well. In terms of the visitor economy and, you know, can Liverpool sustain that? Well, unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever way we look at it, we have to. You know, ultimately, there are no big manufacturing companies still in this part of the world. You know, the shipbuilding, you can see from the top of the city tower this morning, you know, it's not what it used to be. We need more visitors. We need the visitor economy to thrive. You know, whether this plan, unfortunately, I haven't seen the small print, whether this plan is actually what is required remains to be seen. But do we need more tourists in Liverpool? Do we need to build the tourism and visitor economy? Absolutely. We must do that. I think Liverpool as a destination city for weekend breaks is huge. Of course, you've got the usual things that everybody knows about, all the attractions, the football teams, the whole thing. We've got to really play on that. And even I believe that David Cameron also a couple of weeks ago made a point of saying how Liverpool had done so well in showcasing itself and promoting itself as a visitor economy centre. And as far as I'm concerned, and I think as far as most of the business community would be concerned, we can't get enough money from people from outside of our region, because ultimately that will be what keeps the city going, especially with all the regeneration in the city centre. You know, we've built a lot of hotels already. I believe that, you know, some hotel managers with obviously a slight vested interest say that we're up to capacity. I don't think that's the case. You can't get a hotel room in Liverpool at the weekend. There is still some capacity there to be had. So can we build on this sector? Absolutely. Should we? We must.
I think that's an interesting point you raise, actually, Tony, because we had Stephen Roberts, who's the chairman of the Liverpool Hoteliers Association, on the programme a few weeks back, and he was saying that there was a concern about whether or not Liverpool was granting planning permission for too many hotels. But the flip side of that is actually, unless we do, then some of the bigger conferences and bigger attractions that we may be able to get into the city simply won't come. I mean, we are not in a place where, for example, it's going to be easy to accommodate the Labour Party conference next year. And I do think if we're serious about becoming a conference venue, host city for government conferences, hopefully Absolutely. In the future as well, then we need to be a bit more ambitious in our outlook and say, well, OK, you know, the economy is struggling at the moment, so the hotels are not the only sector that are having a tough time. But ultimately, it's about providing the capacity to enable Liverpool to continue to grow as a tourist destination. I also wonder whether or not some of the hotels in the city are of the necessary quality. And I do think that one of the things that's happened with the likes of the Hilton and Novotel and one or two others coming into the city, they've raised the bar, and some people are struggling with that. Hasten to add, not Stephen Roberts, because the Crown Plaza has been at the top of the tree for a long time, but there are some venues in this city that are not to the standard that I would expect in a city that is trying to become, as I say, a tourist hub. And John, what's your take on this?
I think it's hugely important. I agree with Tony, really, that, you know, tourism has got to be a big plank in the city's economic future, and we shouldn't disparage it. I worry that it might end up being the only plank, and that, you know, our aspirations in terms of knowledge economy took a bit of a blow with the announcements about the number of pharmaceutical bioscience companies that are leaving because of a lack of infrastructure. But I think the one thing that we should be attending to is actually increasingly, well, it's improving and ever improving the actual quality of the city's tourism offer. It's, yeah, of course, it's essential that we have the hotels here, we have the infrastructure here, but it's actually having enough things here for people to do so they want, when they come to Liverpool, they want to come back. And I think in some critical areas, the offer is still a wee bit thin, and we're not making enough of some of our assets, and we're not being imaginative enough. I've just come back from San Francisco, which is a city which is incredibly like Liverpool in terms of its size, population, demography, its history as a port, its cultural traditions. It's got its Chinatown. I'll tell you what, though, as a tourism offer, we just don't belong in the same. We're not in the same league, and we shouldn't rest on our laurels in thinking that we're somehow, you know, comparable to cities which have got a really well-established, world-class tourism offer. because we haven't. And whether it's the transport system, being able to get around the city and the city centre, you know, it's still difficult in Liverpool. Navigability is difficult. You know, are we really making the most of, you know, the potential that's there in terms of the cultural heritage in the city? Are we investing to safeguard that in an environment where, you know, huge cuts are going to be made in the cultural offer? You know, what's the position with respect to the future of the Tate, NML, the biennial, etc.? All of these things are very much threatened by the withdrawal of funding from the North West Development Agency, and they're pretty important components in the tourism offer. And then, you know, things like our Chinatown, which is a hugely wasted opportunity and should be more vibrant, have more offer, should more activity, more investment required. And how are we going to bring that investment in? And what are we doing to regenerate those parts of the city centre, which is still, quite frankly, a bit of a turn off to tourists?
Mm. I mean, I think you can look at those comments that you've made, John, either very negatively or actually very positively, because I think given all that, and I wouldn't disagree with a word that you've said, that it's amazing that we've managed to transform Liverpool. And the perception certainly is that we have got a chance now in terms of a visitor economy. I think the Chinatown initiative, for example, that is being looked at the moment, really exciting. If we can get some investment into that part of the world, that would be great. And I think, you know, it's the oldest Chinese community in Europe, I think, Liverpool. So it's right that we should be at the forefront of driving that particular thing forward. But also, I was in a meeting earlier this week, talking about the Ropeworks area and some of the fantastic things you could actually do there with not an awful lot of financial investment. You know, there's been an awful lot of people who've put their own private money into that part of the city who are now looking to take it to the next level. And somebody described it yesterday as, on Friday, as the Soho of Liverpool, which I think you could actually, you know, we take some of the connotations of Soho, not necessarily
good point.
All of them. But
let's have a world-class sex economy in Liverpool that will bring more tourists.
Tony's going to tell us we've already got one.
No, absolutely, yeah. Actually, do you want the number? As it stands now, what we're all saying is that we've still got a fantastic opportunity as a city. Yes, we've come a long way, but yes, we've still got a long way to go. Mm-hmm. You know, in principle, without seeing the small print, you know, I welcome the idea of building it up and doing that. But what it shows is that yes, we've come a long way, but we mustn't rest on our laurels. Keep working, keep investing, because not only have you got tourism jobs, you've got construction jobs, and you've got all the spin-offs as the hotels are being built. You've got the money, the inward investment from all of these international hotels. We still haven't got a Sheraton. We still haven't got lots of different world-class international hotels that actually we should have as a city that has our potential. We should have this. We've come a long way. We've got a long way to go. Let's all get behind this fantastic opportunity and let's do it.
And I think
I'm always going to sound a wee bit negative because it's part of, I'm probably wired that way, but I don't mean to be. And the advances and the progress that's been made is dramatic. But my worry is that there isn't any kind of creative intelligence at the centre that's looking at the actual offer, the overall tourism offer, the visitor experience, and thinking about what are the lateral ways in which we can improve that and enhance that further.
That the Mersey Partnership have said, you know, laid down a 3-year plan. I think 3 years is a little bit optimistic. I think part of that is because of the infrastructure and the lack of offer there is. Fascinating enough, last week I flew back from Amsterdam, and which I think is a fantastic city, and the offer there is tremendous. And I was travelling back, and there was an Asian guy. His name is Kip from Taiwan. And he had on him...
Roger obviously promised him a shout-out. Good morning, Kip.
Moving on. Hi, Kip.
Is he still asleep?
Hey. You're trying to embarrass me now, Caldera. I've got things on you too, mate. He had an A4 map. In fact, he had two copies of an A4 map, which he'd picked up from the tourist office in Amsterdam of Liverpool. And it was a destination that he wanted to come. And when he said, where are the best places to go? I really had to think. And I really thought hard. You know, obviously, there's the Beatles stuff, the museums. And I said the waterfront, Albert Dock, the cathedrals, Anfield. Beyond that, I was struggling a little bit. So, and I've said this before, you know, we live in Liverpool. Actually, we don't know our own city well enough. So as you know, I think coming back to what I said about a 3-year plan being optimistic, yeah. I think there's a lot of PR and marketing to do here as well as further afield.
A lot of what they've done with their waterfront is not grandiose. They've not, you know, it's not been fixated with development corporations coming in and urban regeneration companies coming in and putting down great big slabs of concrete. San Francisco. Right, yeah, a lot of what they've done with the piers and the old Dockland area is use existing dock buildings. If they can't find a sophisticated economic activity, they've not knocked it down and turned it into apartments. You know, it's like farmers markets, independent retail, more leisure, and it's just got this kind of beautiful, low-key informality about
it
livable.
Amsterdam, though, you travel in, it's a major port.
Yeah.
It's a major port. You travel in on the boat, and the estuary is just pure industrial. And there's apart from the fact that it's the leading to a lot of the canals, there's very little been done as a tourist destination, but it's a fascinating place to be.
And what's really exciting as well is hearing you guys this morning chat about San Francisco and Amsterdam. It just shows how much potential we still have.
Yeah.
And as a business community and the business people out there listening, you know, it's not all over. We're not there yet. We're miles away still.
Miles.
We can still do it. We can still aspire, and we can benchmark ourselves as a city and as a region against some of these premier world-class tourist destinations. Yeah. We can do that, and that's got to be the aim of the city, the new council, TMP, everybody else has got to try and make Liverpool a world-class tourist destination. And if this extra investment, if it comes, is actually forthcoming, then I welcome it, and I think everyone should get behind it.
We talk about utilising the dock, and obviously not just for tourism, but for the business of shipping, and plans to build a giant container ship terminal in the city are now under threat because of new environmental guidelines, which were designed in good faith to protect Merseyside's coastline. It's been basically, people are saying Liverpool Bay has been made into the marine equivalent of a national park by the government. So permission for this new terminal is now potentially under threat. Not just around this particular issue, but the whole movement around environmentally friendly, let's tax the car driver to the hilt, all these sorts of policies that have developed over the past 10 years. I read a report last week that was saying that Mars is now overheating. So obviously we're going to have a word with all the car drivers up there as well and start taxing them to the back teeth. I don't want to sound as though I'm going back in time, but are we taking all this green agenda stuff a little bit too far?
You know? Well, it's important, obviously, that we've got to respect the environment that we're in. But without, again, unfortunately, just having come back from Shanghai, I've not seen the small print of the report. But in principle, a much bigger container port for Liverpool. We talk about not relying, being over-dependent on the tourism, the visitor economy. Surely one of our natural advantages of being a port, and a port with such history and such an important past, means that we should be looking to do this in the future. At the end of the day, Liverpool should be the gateway between Europe and North America. And who knows what might happen with the Panama Canal upgrade. I had a meeting with TMP and we had a bit of a chat about this. And you're talking about the Panama Canal being upgraded, potentially even a route being cut across the north of Canada. So you may actually find that product that comes from the likes of Shanghai and Tianjin and all some of these important Chinese ports could actually be coming around the north of Canada. And Liverpool is a logical port, the first port of call, much more important than Hamburg or Rotterdam or Southampton or Felixstowe. We have potentially a really important position. And what we have to do is we have got to make sure as a city and as a region for the whole northwest that Liverpool is in position that should those developments happen, we are ready, because we will have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity as a city and as a region to take advantages of the changes in global shipping, the changes in global trade and global business. And I really hope that we can find a way to kind of appease the environmentalists and make sure that the business and the opportunity is still there, because it's an enormous opportunity for the city. We can't miss the opportunity. You know, I hope that the cruise liner terminal can be sorted out and we can sort that. But the superport, potentially, because of the knock-on jobs, you're talking about distribution centres, you're talking about transport infrastructure improvements, the knock-on effect of such a huge important investment would be absolutely massive for the city. You're talking tens tens of thousands of jobs, whole new industries, and we have got to try and find a way to make this work, because as a city, we need this kind of investment and we need this kind of infrastructure going forward.
I think that the other irony of this is, you know, in terms of the environmental agenda, surely getting more cargo moved on ships helps relieve, you know, other forms of transport, which is apparently not as green friendly. But John, come to you. What do you say to? I know you're very committed to the environmental agenda, but do you think that issues such as this one need to be considered almost as a special case?
I think we kind of collapse into this. It's environment versus jobs. It's environment versus jobs. It's one or the other. Is the green lobby, you know, stifling economic development and regeneration? I think when we look at the details of this particular project, it shouldn't be too difficult to reconcile the objectives of conservation and the opportunities for developing the port and increasing its capacity. You know, if we start off on the basis that we are concerned about and committed to protecting and conserving the Mersey estuary and its environment, then I'm sure that can be built into the design process and we can find a way of reconciling those objectives. But we shouldn't think about the environment as somehow being an anti-economic factor or consideration. Actually, the quality of the environment in this part of the world should be one of our economic assets. Indeed. You know, it is unique. It's part of the extraordinary quality of life that, you know, people in the city region enjoy and experience, and potentially could be used to promote the area, both in terms of its tourism economy and in terms of attracting people to live here and persuading people actually relocating their business to a city region which is as livable as this one is a good thing and a sensible thing for them to do. So, you know, I think we do have to protect our environment, but not just for purely altruistic green reasons, but understanding that actually it's an important component in our economic lifestyle offer as well. We're doing some work at the moment with Veolia, and they're making a major investment in a manufacturing facility in the city region, which I'm not going into detail about now, but it's a low carbon initiative. And in that respect, it's an enormously important and strong environmental argument for doing it. Actually, there's also a very strong economic argument for doing it, because by so doing it, they are massively reducing their natural gas consumption. And that's making the actual process more efficient, more viable, and then ultimately creating more jobs. So there is this way of actually getting the virtuous circle where you can actually have a successful, prosperous, competitive, low-carbon economy, which is, you know, part of our economic future. I think Ed Miliband has been saying something along these lines this week.
I wonder when it's
vote by any chance.
I wonder. Well, obviously someone else who's promised someone a shout-out.
Hi, Ed.
The low-carb...
morning, Ed.
The low-carb economy is something that, again, going back to the action plan and the key themes around the Mersey Partnership strategy for the future, that is one of the key areas where they are saying Liverpool has a competitive advantage. And I think you're absolutely right, John. It really is about getting the balance right, I suppose. And I do think Peel Ports, in terms of the comments that they made on the back of this report, seem to be fairly optimistic that they will be able to do some sort of deal. But just on the broader green agenda, again, Roger and I have been getting battered over the head by one of our colleagues in the office talking about corporate social responsibility. So we're having to get ourselves up to speed far more than we have been in the past on this. But we are, I would say, we're a little sceptical about some of this stuff, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah. If we stop talking in here, you know, the hot air that we're spouting at the moment, is that going to make a big difference? I think Ben Elton was on the TV last week saying, you know, we've all got to play our part, you know, turn your computers off, because that is a minute thing. But a lot of people will look at the, you know, they've opened a new, power station in China, you know, which is pumping out all sorts. What are we going to do that's going to contribute to this and to the reduction of the carbon footprint? And I mean, I'm kind of a little bit like that, I'm afraid. I think there's an ice age coming in the next million years. It's not going to happen in our lifetime. Well,
so Roger doesn't care.
It's not that I don't care. I just think it's over.
You just think it's inevitable.
Yeah, of course. It is inevitable, isn't it? It's going to happen. I mean, you've just mentioned Mars is heating up. You know,
well, that's true. You know, that is what the, you know, if Mars is overheating, well, it's not the Ford driver that's responsible for that. No, my gripe actually is all about, I think John's hit the nail on the head in terms of the environmental agenda. It's not necessarily anti-business, anti-economic development. But I do think that...
But there are certain flag wavers who make such an issue.
I think this thing about, you know, car drivers being the be-all and end-all and as I say, taxing them to the...
It's a respectful, sustainable balance.
Well, what's it like in China then? Because they don't seem to give... Well, it's
changing rapidly. The younger generation... You know, for the people who basically had nothing after Chairman Mao, and you know all the days when you know the people were completely suppressed, it didn't really matter then. It was all, you know, it didn't matter. You know, we can just big state factories pollute, doesn't matter. The ground, the earth will be able to cope with it. It's fine. The next generation of Chinese coming through are very environmentally aware, and they are going to put some serious pressure on their leaders in the next few years to try and sort that out. And what you've also got to remember is per head, the Chinese pollute a far lot less than we do and that the Americans do. You know, we produce, you know, America produces more pollution than China, or there's not much in it, but there are kind of five times more Chinese than Americans. If you actually look at it per head, we do pollute much more than the Chinese, and it's easy for us to sit back in ivory towers or even in Radio City towers and talking about pollution and, oh, China this and China that. But ultimately, we're buying the products as well. You know, we can't kind of just moan at China for all the pollution that it's causing. Still, per head, they pollute less than we do, and ultimately, we as Western consumers buy the products that they make and the power that they use. So I think going back to the potential port, I think John's exactly right. We've got to find a balance. We've got to respect the environment. The environmental lobby, it's a legitimate claim. It's a legitimate issue. But ultimately, we can't miss the opportunity of creating tens of thousands of jobs. We've just got to try and find a good balance that works for both the environment and for the economy.
Well, on that note, with you and John agreeing with one another for once, let's move on to another subject. And let's see if we can get some sort of disagreement over this and make it a bit more exciting. Pro Liverpool have lost Northwest Development Agency funding to the tune of £200,000 per year. That resulted this week in the chief executive being made redundant. And there's a debate taking place this week in the local media, at least. Strangely enough, two different views being taken by the editor and deputy editor of the Liverpool Daily Post. Bill Gleeson was arguing that he doesn't think Liverpool as a city has the number of professional organisations to sustain a professional Liverpool, whilst Tony McDonagh was suggesting that actually, given a fair chance, it would have been able to grow and become a significant player in the city, in the wider city region. Now, again, John, I come to you because I know that you were involved in some way with Pro Liverpool. What do you think the future holds for that particular group?
I think it's tragic. I think it's tragic that we seemingly cannot sustain a professional Liverpool as an organisation, though there is, of course, an argument that with the Chamber and DLIB, perhaps that particular landscape was overpopulated. But I think in Mark Chadwick in particular, I want to pay tribute to somebody who I think secured for this city, you know, some of the most positive, important international media coverage that it has achieved in the last decade. The pieces that he got into, I think it was the Washington Tribune and Le Monde, about Liverpool's revival in terms of financial services and wealth management, which were fantastically positive pieces, which resonated across the media, were hugely important. And of course, the irony is the fact that promoting the fact that Liverpool had established itself as the UK's second centre for wealth management wasn't enough to sustain an organisation like Professional Liverpool. But if we don't invest seriously in increasing the capacity, the profile and the campaigning capacity of our financial services, legal services, professional services community within the city and grow that significantly and rely instead on tourism as a plank for economic revival, we're going to have a massively distorted economy and probably a low-skill, low-wage economy. We've got to be offering talented people in the city opportunities for advancement and success within the professions. Historically, that's what Liverpool's economy was founded on. We gave birth to companies that have, you know, national and international reputations. Some of them got so big they moved. That's part of the problem. But, you know, there's no reason why the city cannot grow its business community in its city centre core and become a major business centre competing with the likes of Liverpool, London, Manchester and Leeds.
Difficult to argue for continued subsidy of an organisation like that, though, isn't it, when you've got a similar group operating down the road in Manchester who, OK, have had development agency cash in the past, but will be able to continue to function when that funding dries up.
I think, unfortunately, people, the organisation, the it was too quick, wasn't it, between moving from a position where subs and membership fees were quite affordable simply because of the subsidy, then appointing Mark, and then the first thing they had to do then was to try and find a way of living without that subsidy. And the fees had to be, you know, to make the organisation competitive and viable, the fees had to be hiked up to a point where it's a difficult sell to those members, particularly when there is competition in the marketplace in terms of what professional Liverpool potentially offering. But I think somehow, even if it's without professional Liverpool, even if it's an informal, more ad hoc arrangement, there has got to be a vociferous lobby group representing the interests of those sectors and promoting the argument and the case that Liverpool is a world-class centre with a world-class offer for companies in those sectors that want to, you know, potentially want to relocate. I think that's what we need to be focusing on.
Again, I'd like to, you know, join John in praising Mark. He did a lot of good work. I remember when we had Chris Grayling and I think Mark Prisk and a few of the other politicians up in the area. We've had a few conversations and one or two meetings with members of Pro Liverpool, and they have worked quite well. But the unfortunate thing is we are living in difficult times, and we do have to make certain cuts in certain areas. And the agency stroke, quango stroke, government support is too wide. You can make a very good point for each and every one of the agencies and the supported, subsidised groups in our region. And collectively and individually, they do some very good work. But the sheer fact of the matter is that we can't afford to have all of that support anymore. It's as simple as that. You know, the taxes that are required to keep these organisations going ultimately should be paid back to business. I, as an entrepreneur, would rather see lower business taxes and less business regulation and more business support in that respect, rather than seeing a lot of my taxes spent on more agencies, more subsidies, more support. I would rather see organisations like Downtown Liverpool, who are private sector led, actually taking the lead. You don't necessarily need hundreds of thousands of pounds. Yeah, yes, occasionally, yes, to get things going, you need a bit of priming in some cases, but you don't need to continually have hundreds of thousands of pounds on an annual basis to get things going. We need to have these agencies sustainable.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid we've fast run out of time. It's been great to have your company this morning. Roger is now off to sort out Downtown's sexy networking evening at the Sir Thomas Hotel on Thursday. Hope to see you down there. Tony's off to go and get his visitor pass for the Liberal Democrat conference that's coming up in the city. And John, no doubt, is going to meet up with Ed Miliband to talk about his leadership and his partnership with Diane Abbott. Thanks to my guests. Thanks you for listening. Thanks to our producer, Jonathan Dean. You have a great week, and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.